This is an ABC podcast.
In an Australian first, virtual reality is being used at Tamworth Regional Hospital for the rehabilitation of victims of brain surgery injury.
Looks like I'm in the bathroom. A toothbrush in a little bowl on that there, a couple of taps.
And it's not all sharing how to grow tomato tips at this community-run farming cooperative in the Blue Mountains.
I like the idea of having young friends. I thought it might be a good way to have some younger people coming to visit me. And I thought it might be good for me and good for them.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Come Friday evening, climbing Uluru will be banned, and many see the closure as an important new chapter in Australian history in moving towards greater recognition of Indigenous cultural heritage. But others have seen it as their last chance. Thousands of Australians have rushed Uluru over the past 6 months to climb the Red Rock before it's banned. Jason Mifsud is the chair of the Eastern Mar Aboriginal Corporation. He says other Indigenous groups are watching the closure of Uluru with great interest. He says the groups are weighing up whether they should consider closing off areas of cultural significance from tourists in order to preserve them. I spoke to him earlier. The closure has meant thousands of Australians have made their way to Uluru to climb the rock before it closes. Many saying they climbed it when they were kids. They want their kids to have that experience and kind of saying, look, Uluru is part of the national park, so we're entitled to walk through it when we want. What do you say to people who say that?
Well, I mean, I think it's just incredibly disappointing that in 2019 we're still ignoring the voice and rights and interests and primacy of traditional owners to make decisions to protect and preserve sites of cultural significance for, you know, future generations. I mean, we're all only custodians at a point in time, and we've inherited that legacy and those values from our senior people and our ancestors, and many of us feel a very strong obligation to maintain those legacies and those traditions. And, in a country that's at least created a rhetoric around reconciliation over the last 20 years, if we're still debating the preservation of cultural sites such as Uluru, maybe the rhetoric of reconciliation has been, had strong intent, but one would argue, given what we've seen at Uluru, been very tokenistic in many other respects.
Will there be other sites of Indigenous cultural significance closed in the future?
I'm sure traditional owner groups are grappling with that question all the time. If I just refer to my own at Eastern Mar in southwest Victoria, where, you know, we have our own particular cultural heritage matters at the moment that we're trying to find resolutions towards in the Grampians, where rock art is being damaged by the rock climbing community. Some in the rock climbing community, I should say. Many in the rock climbing community are very sympathetic and have empathy for Eastern Mar in relation to the inability of government over the last two or three decades to adhere to our wishes to have some of those respective sites shut down. 90% of the Great Ocean Road is on our country, and by 2025 there'll be 8 million visitors on the Great Ocean Road, and we have grave concerns for the natural environment as well as cultural heritage values of Eastern Mar being upheld and contending with that volume of traffic there. So, I mean, these are real life issues, and traditional owners, I think, are really grappling with the fact that, you know, we're a part of a modern economy, but that's not at the compromise of our cultural heritage, and they're difficult decisions. And, you know, I know our group is spending a considerable amount of time trying to work through what the best outcome for our community, our heritage and our future is.
Do you think there is any balance in being able to protect what is culturally significant and then that other thing of the rights of access for everyone to national parks or areas like, well, national parks we're talking about here in the Grampians and Uluru? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is where I think this is where the rights and interests and the knowledge holders, the voice of knowledge holders needs to be understood. I mean, our community for thousands of years have proven to be sustainability experts, and yet we're still locked out of these really meaningful and important discussions around how do you sustain cultural values, environmental values, but also be a contributor to a modern economy and a modern society. And it's where, you know, government legislation's got to be modernised and reformed to allow traditional owners to have not only a seat at the table, because at times that can be a passive seat and a tokenistic seat, but a share of the table to be able to help make those meaningful and important decisions for not only, you know, today's generation, but for future generations. So I'm absolutely of the view that there is a way forward, but the rights and interests and knowledge of traditional owners need to be embedded into that process.
What about people who come from, I suppose, what you would say is a place of fear that, you know, the closure of the Climate Uluru is the tip of the iceberg. Now this is going to happen all around the country.
Well, it's the rights of traditional owners to make that decision. I mean, known means no. It's not necessarily what people are giving up that they should be considering. It should be what future generations are gaining. And I think this is, you know, a societal problem at the moment that we're all being conditioned in the last decade or two to have a very materialistic view on, you know, natural assets and cultural assets, yet don't necessarily take the time to think about grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-great-grandchildren having the same benefits to those natural and cultural assets that we have today. So I think it's a rebalancing and it's a reordering of our values as a society today, and understanding that, you know, Australians are in a very privileged position to have the continuous connection to culture and customs, traditions and languages that our First Nations people have sustained for thousands of years. So a little bit less on what we're giving up, and a lot more on what we're gaining as a result of making these decisions.
Just finally, Jason Mifsud, before I let you go, when it comes to Saturday morning, the new dawn breaks at Uluru, how do you think people will be feeling as they see, you know, those images, which will look very different to the image you described earlier? It'll be a rock with nobody on it. How will they feel seeing that?
Well, I know. I mean, I think I would speak not on behalf of, but for many Indigenous people when there will be an inner peace, in my view, that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will feel when they see that rock in its natural form come Saturday morning. So I think there will be an inner peace that many of our people, many of our communities will start to feel. And I think that'll give us a great sense of calmness that many of us have been traumatised by having seen what's happened there in the last 3 to 6 months in particular. And I think it'll provide, you know, inspiration for other traditional owner groups to be making our own brave decisions around the protection of cultural heritage, despite, you know, the pushback from sections of the non-Aboriginal community to not allow that to happen.
Jason Mifsud, the chair of the Eastern Mar Aboriginal Corporation, thanks for talking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks for your interest.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Across the world, there are many examples of Indigenous groups moving to close places of cultural significance to tourists. Dr. Freya Higgins-Desbiole is from the University of South Australia. Her career has taken her to all parts of the globe, looking at how tourism can be a force to promote peace. She says there was significant backlash when the Devil's Tower in Wyoming in the United States was closed to climbers.
That's an iconic spot, and particularly rock climbers like to climb the Devil's Tower. The climbers are asked not to climb when the Lakota Sioux are doing their ceremonies, that there's a voluntary abstinence from climbing in that period. And so there's well-documented tensions there between the rock climbing leisure community, and those guys communicate some of the same values that you find with Uluru, the Native American interest, and then the Department of Environment controlling the national parks, and how they have to play a role of balancing those two interests. So this right of access and the fact that national parks are public assets comes into tension with indigenous rights, which are limited rights. It's separating them out as having a separate group of rights that can impact upon the common rights of people in national parks. So it's not unusual, you know, Mount Taranaki and climbing to the top of Mount Taranaki in New Zealand is another space. You know, the Maori consider the peak, well, they consider the mountain an ancestor. And so climbing to the top is considered really offensive because it's like the top of your grandfather's head. So this does happen around the world.
Dr. Freya Desbiole from the University of South Australia.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
When we think about virtual technology, we think sight and sound. I mean, virtuality technology. We think about sight and sound, but a new prototype has been developed that adds touch. Victims of brain injury in New South Wales rural and remote areas are being encouraged to join a trial of the equipment, which hopes to aid the recovery of movement and fine motor skills. The Australian first trial has kicked off in Tamworth this week. And as Jennifer Ingle reports, there are hopes virtual reality will allow people receive rehabilitation in remote areas.
For 10 years I've had the work on it.
Yeah. Well, you're doing really well.
I've been at gyms, I've been in here.
Yep.
I've tried them all.
Yep.
And I can't work anything now. That's what it was like. Yeah.
Tony Lane is now keen to try something new. How would you say your recovery's been in that 10 years, Tony?
I think a lot. As my wife might say, only half, but I assure you that I've had a lot. I could work like that, and that's how I left this hospital.
So not much movement in your arm?
No, and little more on my legs, my left, my right hand, things like that.
You're going to be wearing this. It's like a pair of, you want you to wear a pair of ski goggles, and inside that you're going to find an environment that looks
He's
like
agreed to test out a new virtual reality prototype designed to improve movement in his upper limbs. Rowan O'Reilly is the co-developer and describes what will happen.
So basically it's like, remember, if you're looking at a normal TV screen, you're seeing an image in two dimensions and you're just watching it?
Yes.
This is like a situation where you're putting like ski goggles on and you're actually, instead of watching a screen, you're inside.
I've done such a thing, but only when I'm still watching TV.
Right, okay.
I haven't done it real.
Would you like to try it? Would you like to see what it's like?
Well, I always will.
Good. So what we're going to do is we're going
Colin Nielsen is also keen to test out the technology. He's already taken the step from a rehab ward into another world.
Looks like I'm in the bathroom. A toothbrush and a little bowl on that there. Couple of taps.
12 months ago, Colin also suffered a stroke.
Well, my right side's paralysed. Just had to learn how to walk and all that sort of thing again.
He's wearing goggles and a high-tech glove that measures movement. The prototype looks like something out of science fiction.
It's basically like an octopus, an electrical octopus sitting on your hand, and like a sleeve that fits over your forearm, and inside that are encased all the electrical goodies. At the moment, that's all powered by internal batteries, and that system communicates with the software in the virtual environment. So there's actually this active communication going on that's guiding the system and helping to increase movement.
This new technology is making therapy as simple as cleaning your teeth.
Yes, our toothbrush on your left-hand side. Grab the toothbrush.
Yep.
There's an avatar in there that talks to them, and it tells them what they're going to do, and it basically encourages them to practice, and then it rewards them. In certain ways. So, for example, one of our reward structures may be, you've successfully brushed your teeth. Brilliant. What's next? So there's a bath filling up in the other side of the bathroom and bubbles are coming up. And so your reward is, you just naturally you want to pop the bubbles. Well, the beautiful thing about this haptics technology allows you to feel bubbles in the virtual world, and you can't help it. You just keep popping the bubbles, and that's a form of therapy. Your reward is actually therapy too, but you just want to pop the bubbles, yeah.
A full medical prototype is still about 18 months away. Today marks the beginning of a series of trials in Tamworth.
One of the key parts that I've got really high hopes for is that we can actually apply this in a remote setting. So if someone is from a smaller outlying area where there is less services, then there's the possibility, because it's very portable, that possibly this could be applied in that remote setting, and that the data can then come back to a setting like the rehab unit here at Tamworth Hospital. The therapist can then look at that and suggest changes or implement other types of therapy if needs be. So I think that's a really exciting part of this as well.
That's Dr. Luke Wakeley from the University of Newcastle's Department of Rural Health. He's excited at the chance of testing the device before the equipment hits the market.
Often these devices are put out into and consumers are asked to buy them, and there's no research or evidence behind whether they actually work or not.
The system developers will also trial the equipment on the New South Wales Central Coast. Their dream could be life-changing for some people.
The dream is to get people their function back. You know, there's so many people out there who've been left with partially paralysed hands and arms, and we believe that the majority of those people will benefit by this system. And I think more importantly, it's fun.
Meantime, Colin is more than happy to be a guinea pig.
It felt real, like it was right here, all that stuff. And if that thing there does what he says, it'll be unreal.
Jennifer Ingle with that story from Tamworth. A community-run farming cooperative in the New South Wales Blue Mountains is linking up property owners who have land to spare with aspiring food growers. It's called the Farm It Forward Project, and it's turning residential plots into productive organic market gardens, and it's also bringing people together. Luke Wong went along to dig in and see how it all works.
The first soil is being turned on a project that will not only transform this Blue Mountains neighbourhood, but also what food the people living here will eat.
We've realised that actually there are a lot of people in the mountains who want their plots to be productive, but they either are young couples with children who may not have the time or are commuting to the city for work, or they're older people who may have mobility issues or don't have the possibility, physical possibility, to keep their plots productive.
Manu Prigioni started the Farm It Forward program to create market gardens on unused residential land to grow organic fruit and vegetables to sell locally. It's an idea that grew originally from a desire to connect with others and has blossomed into something more.
I struggled being a young mum with a baby by myself in the mountains. And I found that social isolation was a very real problem out here, and that was really what fueled starting an enterprise like this one.
And Farm It Forward turned out to be what Rosie Lee and her husband were looking for after moving from Sydney's busy inner suburbs. They had dreams of growing their own flourishing veggie garden, but it didn't go quite to plan.
It was more of a nice idea. We had kind of started and had some things growing, but it wasn't as, I guess, fruitful and productive as we'd like it to be, especially with a 7-month-old. So when Manu pitched the idea to us, I thought, great, well, if we're not going to use it, then someone else can. And it just seemed like such an amazing project to be part of.
So they volunteered the land around their house in return for some of the food produced from the garden. And it has the added bonus of community connections. Still in the early stages of cultivating new gardens, the project relies on young aspiring farmers to get things up and running. Jack Galuzzi is one of them.
I hope to work on the farms that we're building for quite some time, and also to train young people to be able to then take over the farms or start their own farms.
Come harvest time, what's grown in the gardens will end up at the Littleton stores in Lawson. The not-for-profit food co-op has grown to 650 members since it began in 2015. Every week, store workers prepare boxes of organic fruit and vegetables ready for pickup in the region. Store operator Jacinta Carmichael Parisi says they're working on limiting food mileage as much as they can.
So at the moment, the organic produce that we have available is kind of working on a national level, on a national system. And what we would really like to do is create a food system that is much more localised, that we still have the variety and the availability of nutritious organic produce all year round. But hopefully with Farm It Forward, we'll be able to grow enough produce that we'll be able to supply our community members with produce from just our local area.
Sylvia May loves her 2-hectare bush property, but as she gets older, maintaining it is difficult. For her, Farm It Forward is a perfect fit to help her stay here as long as she can and make new friends.
It does feel wonderful because I'm very much aware that I won't always be able to do heavy work, and a big garden needs heavy work. So making friends with young people might be very helpful for me when it comes to the heavy work. Because I like the idea of people helping each other. I like the idea of having young friends. I thought it might be a good way to have some younger people coming to visit me. And I thought it might be good for me and good for them.
Yes, no, that's fine. Yes.
It makes me feel very optimistic about being able to continue to live on my bush block as I get older.
People are joining Farm It Forward every week, and Manu hopes this project is just the beginning of something much bigger.
What I hope is really to fine-tune this model so that it can be used as a blueprint for other semi-rural areas all over Australia.
Luke Wong with that story from the Blue Mountains. In recent years, the clothing industry has become filled with what we call fast fashion. It may be cheap, but it's not designed to last and can end up in landfill. A group of primary students in central Queensland are doing their part to combat this by learning the traditional craft of sewing. Karen Wilson has the details.
Well, you may have heard of the term fast fashion. It sews items of clothing produced at high volumes and sold at affordable prices. Well, with most of the fast fashion made from synthetic fibers, it's not biodegradable and can have a big impact on the environment. But a group of primary students in regional Queensland are doing something to curb their reliance on cheap fashion. They're learning to sew. Teaching them the basics is Wendy Hudson, a teacher librarian who converted her garage into a sewing class.
I felt that there was a need because Mum was a sewer and I love sewing, and kids at school, there's teachers that do sewing and I know how much they enjoy it, so Little So-and-Sos was born. I started in October last year. I had 8 students enrol, and every term since then I have another couple joining, and now I've got 16 students, so it's really gained in popularity.
When I heard that you were doing this class, I kind of thought, sewing and kids, do they really enjoy that? Like, it went out of fashion for a while. Do you think it's gaining in popularity again?
Definitely. I think they're more environmentally aware and making their own clothes rather than buying them and throwing them away when they wear out. They can learn how to adjust their clothes if they need to. They're like little sponges. They just absorb everything that you show them. And I suppose the other thing too with sewing is I had a lady say to me, you know, if I need something done, I just take it to grandma and she does it. But those grandmas are disappearing. Who do you take it to then when they're all gone?
Sewing teacher Wendy Hudson there speaking about creating a sewing class for primary students. Since Ms. Hudson opened the doors to her class about a year ago, the number of students who have enrolled has doubled. I spoke to several of them, first to 13-year-old Sachin Stubbs, who had a specific reason why he wanted to sign up.
My great-grandma was very good at it, and I wondered whether I was good at it too.
Tell us a bit about the clothes you've made.
I've made shirts and shorts and stuff.
Why do you think you enjoy it so much, even, you know, it can be a bit frustrating?
Because it's fun to do, and like, it's fun to see your finished project.
What would you like to do with your sewing? Is it just something you like to do as a hobby, or would you like to do something more?
As a career when I'm older. Ella?
Why did you want to take sewing lessons?
My mum and nan always made things for me and my cousins and that, and I thought maybe I'd be able to do what they did.
Do you also kind of look at this as a way to, you know, make your mark on the environment?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it also saves a lot of money for mum instead of going out and buying me clothes.
Thanks to Karen Wilson for that story from Central Queensland. Now, Australia Wide will be coming to you from Mackay tomorrow, and I'll speak to you later on in the week from Uluru. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.